The witness of ancient wisdom today is Luke chapter 15, verses 11 through 32. Then Jesus said, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the wealth that will belong to me.' So he divided his assets between them. A few days later, the younger son gathered all he had and traveled to a distant region. And there he squandered his wealth in dissolute living. When he had spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout that region, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of the region, who sent him to his fields to feed the pigs. He would gladly have filled his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough and to spare? But here I am dying of hunger. I will get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands.' So he set off and went to his father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran and put his arms around him and kissed him. Then his son said to him, 'But father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his slaves, 'Quickly, bring out a robe, the best one, and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. And get the fatted calf and kill it and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his elder son was in the field, and as he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of the slaves and asked what was going on. He replied, 'Your brother has come back safe and sound.' Then he became angry and refused to go in. His father came out and began to plead with him. But he answered his father, 'Listen, for all these years I have been working like a slave for you, and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you have never given me even a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came back, who has devoured your assets with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him.' Then his father said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice, because this brother of yours was dead and has come to life. He was lost and has been found.'" The Witness of Modern Wisdom is from the dedication from UCC Harm Reduction Sunday Toolkit. For all those whom we have loved and lost, and for all those who need to know that they are loved and are not lost, God is still speaking, and we are still listening. Thanks be to God.
Thank you, Judy. Will you pray with me? Merciful God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our help and our Redeemer. Amen. I never imagined that part of my work as a pastor would involve deciding if Narcan would be added to our first aid kit. For years, our kits contained bandages and antiseptic wipes and maybe some aspirin, things for scraped knees and headaches. But then one day, I learned that someone had an overdose just outside our building, just at the very entrance, just a few yards from where we gather each Sunday to sing hymns and share prayer requests together. So I talked about it with key staff, and we didn't debate it for very long. We decided to add Narcan to those first aid kits in both buildings, this building and our other building. If the name Narcan is unfamiliar to you, it is a brand name for naloxone. It's a nasal spray, a powerful medicine that is now available to all of us, but a medicine that can reverse the effects of opioids like fentanyl. Many overdoses happen to people who don't even know that they have taken fentanyl. They think they're taking some other drug, meth or cocaine, something that they think they know, but they are unaware of their risk. And in those moments, Narcan isn't just medicine, it is time. It is breath. It's the difference between a funeral and a person having a future. But putting that box on the wall next to the AED wasn't just an administrative decision or a practical decision. It was a theological decision. Because in doing this, we are making a statement about what we believe grace looks like. It's us answering the question, do we wait for someone to be clean before we love them? Or do we love them enough to keep them breathing even while they are still lost? I've realized I've been pastoring in one form or another for now a little over 20 years. In that time, I've seen a few examples of what I would call miracles, stories about recovery and redemption. I've heard testimonies where someone says, I was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see. I remember a young man from one of my first youth groups who started using drugs and then more dangerous and deadly drugs. And then one day, he overdosed and had a near-death experience. And after several years of recovery and relapse, he went to rehab. And this time, it stuck. And he spent the last 15 years turning his trauma into fuel for his art, his poetry. Now others reading his words find solace and understanding. His story brings me hope. And I'm so proud of him for that journey. But I also carry other stories. I remember a young woman who experienced profound trauma in her early life. And her family was not well off. She did not have a lot of support. And despite teenage pregnancy, she was able to finish school and to begin to build a life. She had a husband and two children, a home and a job. But in the end, she couldn't shake off the weight of her accumulated trauma. And one day her ex-husband called me to tell me that she wasn't well and he was worried about her. And the next week he called again to say she had overdosed. Her friends and family were grieving, but honestly, they weren't surprised. They knew her struggles. They knew the pain that she had carried for so long. And they had worried all along that it was only a matter of time. I know stories like these, and I know stories of parents, some in their 70s and 80s, who wake up every morning wondering about their adult children. They're afraid of phone calls at odd times of day or night because they don't know if the next call will be from the police or the hospital or the morgue. Many are at their wits' end. They don't know how to love their child anymore. Some have asked me many different versions of the same questions. You know, Pastor, what does love look like in a situation like this? What is enabling? Where is the line between helping and hurting? And I know that there are children, too, who've been disowned and cut off from parents and families because they wouldn't or couldn't stop using. Siblings who really wish their families would set a clear, hard boundary, that they would begin to practice some kind of tough love because they worry about those parents. They worry about the impact of children and others. How many of us here today have someone in our lives with a substance use disorder? If I asked you to raise your hand, I would think that there'd be a lot of hands raised in this room. How many of us know, too, that story is complex? How many of us know that it doesn't always come to a nice, tidy end? How many of us know that recovery isn't a straight line from good to bad to good again, but a winding road full of setbacks, small victories, relapses, and then quiet, everyday courage? We live in a world that loves a simple story. Simple, easy to understand stories. We love the hero's journey, where there is a clear departure, and then trial, and then a return, and finally the triumph. Isn't that the story of the Odyssey we've all been hearing about? We love these stories. And when we turn to the Bible, this text we look to for wisdom and guidance, we sometimes imagine that these stories are simple stories. I think especially of this parable that Jesus tells, sometimes called the parable of the prodigal son, from Luke chapter 15. It's actually the last of three stories that Jesus tells about lost things, things that have been lost and then found. It reads almost like a fairy tale. A man had two sons. You know the rest. The younger son asked for his inheritance early, which in that culture was essentially saying, I wish you were dead so I could have all your money. But the father agrees. The son takes it. He goes away. He squanders everything in dissolute living. And when he's finally spent it all, he finds himself in a filthy pigsty, the worst of the worst places to be. And he realizes he's finally hit rock bottom. He rehearses a speech in his head. Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. And he begins the long walk home. Let me ask you, do you think he had gotten sober? Do you think he was fully fixed or transformed? Or was he just broken, hungry, and ashamed, with nowhere else to go? When you bring this modern lens to this ancient story, it starts to fill you with more questions, doesn't it? But then it says in verse 20, a verse we sometimes skip over on our way to the party. It says, while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. And he ran to his son, and he threw his arms around him, and he kissed him. While he was still a long way off, the father was looking out the window, waiting to see him. Do you notice the father in the story didn't wait to hear his rehearsed speech? He didn't wait for him to make a confession, didn't wait for proof of sobriety, didn't wait for the son to get a job or join a support group or promise to get with the program. He saw him coming a long way off and ran to him. Now, maybe you've heard it before, but in first century Jewish culture, a patriarch does not run. Running exposed the legs beneath the robe. It was undignified. It was shameful. But this father shames himself to save his son. He runs towards the smell of the pig pen and poverty and shame. Why? Because he knows something we too often forget. After all his midnight worrying, he now knows his son is alive, and that matters more than anything. So he says, bring the best robe, put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet, bring the fatted calf and kill it, and let's celebrate. He does not say, first, you need to attend 12 meetings, or first, I need you to submit to this random drug test, or first, make restitution for the money you stole, and then, perhaps, we'll have a party. That is not the father's logic. But that is our logic of what is fair and right and maybe wise. There's a scholar named Carolyn Ware who studies theology and medicine and is studying at one of our UCC schools, Iliff School of Theology in Denver, Colorado. She writes about something she calls the prodigal effect. She points out how many Christian communities suffer from this ailment. She says, in practice, Christian communities talk a lot about grace, but what they do says something else. They treat grace more like a transaction. They say that our care is conditional on you getting clean. They think, we will love you, support you, welcome you back, but only after you get sort of cleaned up a little bit. Only after you get at least the beginning of a transformation. Only after you prove that you've changed. But that's not everyone's story, is it? Not everyone makes it to that place. At least not on our timetable. And too often we reframe relapse as a personal failure, even as a moral failure. If you slip up, we think, don't help them anymore. They took advantage of our generosity once, so if you do it again, they'll just keep taking and taking and taking. Have you ever tried to help people who need help? You ever felt like your generosity was taken advantage of? You start to feel a little resentful. You start to feel a little bitter. I think about this older brother. I don't think he was evil. I don't think he was wrong. I think maybe he was just tired. Maybe he was suffering from a little bit of compassion fatigue. I don't know what it was like to grow up with that younger brother, to watch how he manipulated his parents whenever he needed something. Maybe he's seen this story a few times before, and he is hesitant to believe in his brother's genuine repentance. At the end of the day, the older brother believes that love is earned through obedience. He believes that because he stayed home, because he followed the rules, because he worked hard, he deserves the special treatment. And because his brother did none of those things, because he broke the rules, he deserves punishment or at least accountability. He doesn't deserve a celebration, maybe at most just a cool homecoming. I think, you know, as many people do, maybe he just worries about his parents being taken advantage of. Does any of that sound familiar to you? Have you ever seen someone you care about going through a situation like this? How many times have we said to someone we know struggling with addiction, "We supported you through rehab. We paid for the program. We prayed for you. Why are you using again? You owe us better than this." When we say that, we are standing in the field there with the older brother. We are judging the father's heart. We are demanding that God operate on a ledger of debts and credits. And we're missing the matrix of other factors that contribute to a person's healing and wholeness. The study of harm reduction teaches us a different and important truth. Harm reduction is not about enabling sin. It is about recognizing that death is not a lesson. Death is just death. Harm reduction is pragmatic, not dogmatic. It teaches us to meet people where they are, not where we wish they were. Give them Narcan. Offer clean needles. Sit with them in the withdrawal. Listen without demanding that they get their lives together first. Provide housing, even if they aren't clean and sober. But get them connected with the network of resources that they need. Mental health support, housing, health care. Whatever their situation, reduce the harm, preserve their dignity, and keep them alive. Because every small step away from death is holy. I don't know about you, but I never looked at this story in quite this way. I always assumed the younger son was finally clean and sober, had gotten his life turned around at least to come home. The father throws the party before his youngest son is fixed. He celebrates the return, not the perfection. And he values the relationship more than the hoped-for result. So what does this mean for us as a church today as we mark Harm Reduction Sunday? I believe it is an invitation to unlearn the idea that holiness looks like cleanliness, to understand instead that holiness looks like compassion. It means we stop asking, "Have you gotten clean?" and start asking, "Are you safe? Are you fed? Do you know that you are loved?" It means we understand that addiction is not a moral failing. It is a complex interplay of biology and trauma and genetics and systemic inequalities. as harm reduction scholars remind us, there are serious gaps in our healthcare system. There are serious systems of neglect and abuse. And there are people who have tried to quit 10 times and failed 9. Does the 9th failure cancel out the 10th chance? The answer must be no. I'm really proud that our denomination has a team of people dedicated to teaching about harm reduction. I'll confess, I did not know what that was all about when I first went to a general synod and I saw someone wearing a button that said, "People who use drugs are beloved of God." But they advocate for policies that save lives. They remind us that Jesus ate with sinners and tax collectors before they got their lives in order, even while they were still finding their way. They remind us that Jesus didn't wait for the lepers to be healed before he touched them. He touched them, and they were healed. Our task is not to judge the timeline of someone's recovery. Our call is to keep the doors open, to keep the table set, to believe, even when they don't, that they are beloved. Maybe some prodigals don't come home tonight. Maybe they come tomorrow. Maybe they need 10 chances. Maybe they never fully get it together in the way that we would define that. As long as they are breathing, they are worth running toward. That is the message of good news that we celebrate today. I hope I'll never have to use the Narcan in our first aid kit. I hope I will get to replace it when it expires. But if it's ever needed, I'm glad it's here. Because if someone collapses outside of these doors or inside them, I want us to be prepared, not just with medicine, but with our presence, our care, and our support. I hope I'll never have to pray with a parent after their child nearly loses their life to an overdose. But if I do, I want to be able to sit with them in that terror without offering platitudes, without blaming, just holding space for their grief and their fierce, stubborn, unrelenting love. People who use drugs are beloved of God. People recovering from addiction are beloved of God. The parents, siblings, partners watching from the sidelines are beloved of God. Even the tired, resentful, older brothers among us are beloved of God. There is no single story. Each story is unique. Every prodigal is someone's child. And every setback is a cry for help. Every survival is a miracle. And my prayer is that we will be the church that runs toward the broken, not away from the messy. Let us measure our success not in testimonies of sobriety only, but by the number of lives that we've learned to hold close. Amen. I invite us to hold those people who we care about in our hearts as we stand and sing our responsive song, "Make Me a Channel of Your Peace."